BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
On a French TV newscast in 1991, something strange happened.
The show was organised by TV. I was invited because I'd published a book in 1988 called The Secret Services under François Mitterrand, which I'd written with my colleague, Bernard Violet. So I was invited to the show, pretty classic, to speak about a book, nothing exceptional. And I was surprised to see Jean-Bernard Condat arrive.
Condat was a skinny young guy with huge glasses, sporting a fabulous Chaos Computer Club France t-shirt.
I didn't know Condat. The TV had done something they wanted to be a bit sensationalist, to do, I think, an experiment of some hacking live. So I see Condat do this program. He was a young man, a bit funny, but he didn't seem very serious to me. It seemed to me, even without knowing the field very well at the time, that this was not something very serious.
But not all was as it seemed.
What I didn't know at all at the time was that he'd been sent there by the police.
I'm Gabriella Coleman, a professor of anthropology at Harvard, and this is The Hackers, a series that delves into the hidden histories of hacking and uncovers how hackers shape the world as we know it. In this episode, we're investigating the time that France compelled young hackers to serve the nation.
Je m'appelle Jean Guinel.
My name is Jean Guinel. I've been a journalist since I was pretty young. I started at the age of 20.
He would go on to become a renowned journalist specializing in defense and the secret services, and one of the first journalists to cover the nascent field of cyber warfare.
In 1984-85, I became defense correspondent for the paper, and I dealt also with intelligence matters. In 1985, we had an enormous intelligence affair, the biggest crisis of Mitterrand's presidencies, the Greenpeace affair. This was a team of French Secret Service officers who sank the Rainbow Warrior boat of the Greenpeace organization at Auckland Harbour in New Zealand. It sank the boat with a combat unit so that it would not go to French Polynesia, where there were nuclear tests taking place. The paper asked me to work on military issues, activities of state defense, attacks, military operations. That was the visible part of my work. I started to work very intensely, because of the Greenpeace affair, on the secret services. I realized quickly that there is the visible activity of defense on one hand, and on the other, the invisible one of secret services. Inside the secret services universe, there was a sector even more secret than the others, the hackers. I found this was fascinating, to work on this modern version of the underground war.
French hacker culture at the time was not as cohesive as in the United States or elsewhere in Europe, which had notable groups like the Loft, Cult of the Dead Cow, and Germany's Chaos Computer Club. French hackers in the underground were more disparate and isolated, which meant if they made a mistake, perhaps they did not have safety in numbers.
The story I reconstructed afterwards, and which I described in the book Cyber Wars, is that Jean-Bernard Condat was a pretty brilliant young man, a musician who played the organ in churches, and he had committed a small youthful mistake in the early 1980s. When he developed hacking skills with expertise on computer penetration, the police remembered him. I just want to say here about this police unit. The contact with Condat is re-established in the late 1980s by the police, which finds a judicial way of putting pressure on him. The police unit is the DST, the Direction de la Surveillance du Territoire. This is similar to the FBI in the US or MI5 in the UK. It is the defense of the national territory against foreign intrusions. It is a counter-espionage service working with justice, in principle. In France, you must always add, in principle. So, in principle, the DST works under the control of a judge, unlike the Foreign Secret Service, which works on its own, without any judicial control.
The problem the DST had at the time was they had no personnel with hacking skills. Cyber warfare was a whole new world, and they didn't know how to operate in it. The real experts were teenagers, self-taught kids who understood networks, vulnerabilities, and techniques of intrusion, as well as destruction. The DST needed those abilities, so they had to get the hackers on their side.
Comme avec Jean-Bernard Conda.
How do they do this? As with Conda, they seek everywhere in France young men who have this skill that they acquired on their own. When they spot these young people, when they know who they are, because they made a mistake or they spoke in the hacking community, they look for a means of pressure to make them work for them. It means finding in the life of a hacker the small, youthful mistake which will make it possible to scare him.
I've actually spoken to a few of those who made the odd, youthful mistake. Lots of them started young, with video games acting as a gateway to coding. And then what do clever but broke kids do? They hack into networks to connect with others. In France, the early network was Minitel. Eventually, many of these kids got more skilled, both in the art of hacking and in the art of social engineering, hacking human operators to land illicit information. One guy I talked to, a master of social engineering, said, and I quote, "I could call any company and get them to give me their password." I mean, you had kids playing with phone phreaking, manipulating secret service agencies around the world, and causing all kinds of minor mayhem. Enough to get the attention of the authorities. And then the cops, well, they called their parents. "Hey, your kid did something stupid. You don't want them to end up in jail. Tell them to come in for a chat." Perhaps the enraged mothers were more terrifying than the police. Many didn't end up in jail because the authorities, well, they had better use for them.
These are adolescents who at that time in France all had to do what we call military service because conscription existed in France until the end of the 1990s. So the deal they do with these young people is very simple. They go to see them, they say, "You have made a mistake, you have to pay your debt to society." How will you pay your debt? Well, instead of doing military service, marching in the countryside and sleeping at night in a tent, you will come to work at DST, and for a year, you will put your talents at the service of France. This had the added advantage that these young people, who had scientific skills and who were called the scientists of the contingent, were paid a bit. So that was good for everyone. The youths who did the hacking were protected by the police and able to use means much greater than what they had in their bedroom. And the DST gained skills it did not have. So it was a win-win deal, as they say in English.
They were put to work, and their youth was no barrier to what they were expected to do. These teens were catapulted into the murky world of cyber espionage.
I was put on the path of these hackers working for the DST by a French intelligence officer who spoke anonymously to me. It was a long time ago. He explained to me that the DST used Parisian hackers to fight against militant Lebanese networks, which I didn't identify precisely. The procedure was typical of hackers. In the early 1990s, end of the 1980s, hackers working for the DST penetrated banks in sub-Saharan Africa through computers. They stole money, penetrated bank accounts, and took the money of rich Lebanese settled in Africa who funded networks in the Middle East. I don't know exactly what networks, but it's possible they were linked to terrorists.
Other activities hackers were doing at the time were penetrating computers, digging for hidden information, or generally causing incidents that targeted people or machines of interest. Mainly, it was all about information. Some worked pretty formally. Basically, it was a day job. Others worked in a less formal capacity, meeting with handlers once a month to offer insights and relaying what was possible in the hacker world.
Conda's role could be, how can we say this, that of a camera which moves inside the world of hackers. The DST did not have the means to penetrate this milieu. It was too young, too closed, too varied. But Conda penetrated it because he was part of it.
French hacker society was a bit on edge, though. Paranoia was rampant because it was known some hackers worked with the government. And Conda was not the most technically adept, so some viewed him with suspicion. But for his purposes, it didn't matter that much.
The essential aspect is that he is going to guide the DST, which is like someone who is blind and deaf. It didn't know what was happening in that world. It didn't know the people. It didn't know the map of networks. It was on an impenetrable terra incognita for generational and competence reasons. So Konda would play that role, the role of guide. The TV show of 1991 had the role of exposing Konda to all of France, to show that he's someone who presents well, who speaks easily about subjects, and who can therefore attract people to him. I think he had a role at the time, the classic one in intelligence, that of the honeypot, as we call it in French, the honeypot you expose in the light of day to attract bees and insects. That was Konda's role. He allowed the DST to get contacts through him, directly or indirectly, with young people it would not have managed to reach otherwise. This was his social role.
Konda was not a helpless victim of the state. He and some of his peers enjoyed their role.
I remember him as friendly, pretty attractive. He had a good sense of humor, very caustic. He was a tool aware of the exotic nature of his behavior. I think he did this chiefly for fun. He had an officer responsible for him. When he had information, he could call day and night. Inspectors would rush to him to verify this or that.
And there were practical benefits for conscripted hackers. With authorities on their side, hackers could be far more effective at what they wanted to do.
I'll take a brief example. A hacker has the skills to go into a computer and get very far, but sometimes he's blocked by the stupid issue of the password. How can you find out the password? The name of the target's dog, the name of his sister or his mother, the first name of his father, which are passwords used very often. The police could give this.
Originally, the DST was the only player in town. But when Jean published about the hackers at the heart of the Secret Service, other agencies grew interested.
So when my book came out in 1995, I had the very big surprise of being called by the Chief of Staff of the Army, which is the equivalent to the Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the USA. They asked me to come and see them for a meeting, and around the table there were military officers, a dozen people. I immediately understood they were DGSE, and we had an absolutely fascinating conversation on how they wanted to understand how I became interested in the subject, how I tackled it, what interested me, how things worked. It wasn't a police interrogation. It was people who were frankly interested in something they didn't know. What I want to say is that the problem today is that France is a target. Its wealth, its talents, its innovations are the target of thousands of powerful and constant attacks each day. So I think the issue today is more the protection of France than the way it attacks other countries. It's a different political culture.
France and other nation states eventually built their own official teams and didn't need to press gang hackers for their knowledge. But there was a time when nation states were in the dark. And it's ironic how they had to rely on outlaws to kickstart nation-state hacking and cyber espionage. For the hacker community, this is a history that has yet to be told and fully understood, even among themselves. These were teenagers, after all, and though some likely did enjoy playing spy, others were vulnerable and deeply impacted by what they did. It's a story that exists only in fragments. Most is still lost in the midst of the secret universes of both hackers and the intelligence agencies. We may never know the impact that a few teens who made youthful mistakes had on the world, not just in hacker circles, but in global politics.